From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Old rocking chairs got me, came by my side.
On today's Fresh Air, the music of Mildred Bailey, a great singer who was very popular in the 30s and 40s, but since then hasn't gotten her due. A new 10-CD box set of her recordings has just been released. We'll talk with Will Friedwald, who wrote the extensive liner notes. Also, John Ritter talks about his new movie Panic, his 70s sitcom Three's Company, and his father, singing cowboy and country music star Tex Ritter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Have the flies around my rocking chair.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush visited an army base in Georgia today to announce his plans to boost military spending. He promised the soldiers about $5.7 billion for pay raises, better housing, and medical benefits.
We owe you and your families a decent quality of life. We owe you the training and equipment you need to do your jobs. And when we send you into harm's way, we owe you a clear mission with clear goals.
Despite today's announcement, the president's commitment to increased military spending was questioned today on Capitol Hill. More from NPR's David Wellner.
Senator Joe Lieberman is in an adversarial mode once again after losing his bid to be vice president. Lieberman sent President Bush a letter expressing concern over reports there will effectively be no new military funding in next year's budget to improve what he called an unacceptable level of readiness. Lieberman said as a candidate, the president promised the military that help is on the way.
Now that he is in the White House, President Bush seems content to tell our fighting forces not that help is on the way, but that the check is in the mail.
Lieberman said more than half the new defense funding promised by Mr. Bush is already mandated by law, and he warned the president's proposed $1.6 trillion tax cut leaves little for increased defense spending. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Napster says it will fight an appeals court ruling that could put its internet music swapping service out of business. A three-judge panel said Napster could be liable if it allows its millions of customers to share copyrighted music. The recording industry welcomed the ruling. Israeli Prime Minister-elect Ariel Sharon hit an impasse today in his efforts to form a national unity government with outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Barak's Labor Party. Meanwhile, clashes in the West Bank left one Israeli and two Palestinians dead. Jean Marie Condon reports from Jerusalem.
Labor, which is still the largest party in the Israeli parliament, went into a meeting with Sharon's people with a list of preconditions for joining Sharon's government, among them that he had to agree to resume negotiations with the Palestinians and to dismantle some Jewish settlements to make way for a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. All were components of a peace plan formed by the outgoing Prime Minister Ehud Barak. Labor emerged from today's meeting saying their talks with the Sharon team were deadlocked. Last night, an Israeli man was killed in the West Bank by Palestinian gunmen. Today, a Palestinian man was killed by Israeli fire while riding in a minivan in an area where soldiers were clashing with Palestinian stone throwers. A second Palestinian was killed by Israeli soldiers when he attempted to drive past a military roadblock. For NPR News, I'm Jean Marie Condon in Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 165 points or 1.5%. This is NPR News. Computer security experts are warning people who use Microsoft Outlook that there's a new virus spreading through the email system. It's known as the Kornikova virus because it sends a message that purports to include a picture of Russian tennis star Anna Kornikova. The subject line says something to the effect of "here it is" or "here you are." The experts say the message should be deleted, unopened. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan testifies before the Senate Banking Committee tomorrow. Wall Street will be watching for comments on another possible reduction in interest rates. Other Fed policymakers are making cautiously upbeat comments about the nation's economic outlook. Steve Beckner reports from Market News International.
Some analysts and politicians say the economy is so weak it needs some mix of tax cuts and new interest rate cuts. But several Federal Reserve Bank presidents who vote on rates have cast doubt on how bleak things really are. The latest is Boston Federal Reserve Bank President Kathy Minahan. She said the economy is going through a significant but relatively short-lived inventory correction and said the economy may well be growing, though quite slowly. She predicted a rebound strong enough to permit 2% average growth this year. Minahan said the economy should weather what she called short-term adjustments thanks to sound fundamentals. She said the 2.5 percentage point rate cuts the Fed made last month should boost confidence and, in turn, consumer and business spending. She said the Fed does need to stay vigilant, though. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
House Speaker Dennis Hastert was released from the hospital this afternoon after having emergency surgery. Hastert was operated on for kidney stones at a suburban Chicago hospital last night. A spokesman for the Illinois Republican said the surgery went well. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mildred Bailey was one of the great jazz singers of the 30s and 40s. Although she was very popular in her time, she hasn't gotten her due in subsequent years. A new 10-CD box set may help to change that. It features her Columbia recordings from 1929 to 42 and has been released by Mosaic Records. My guest, Will Friedwald, wrote the extensive liner notes for the set. He's also the author of Jazz Singing and Sinatra, The Song Is You. Friedwald calls Bailey one of the essential missing links of American music. As Gary Giddens describes in his new book about Bing Crosby, it was Mildred Bailey who introduced Crosby to the recordings of Louis Armstrong. Bailey and Crosby are considered the first white singers to pick up on Armstrong's rhythmic innovations. As you'll hear, Mildred Bailey had a great sense of rhythm, whether she was singing a swing song or a ballad. Let's start with her 1935 recording of When Day Is Done.
When day is done and shadows fall, I dream of you. When day is done, I think of all the joys we knew. That yearning, returning, to hold you in my arms. Won't go, love, I know, love. Without you, night has lost its charms. When day is done, grass is wet with twilight's dew. My lonely heart is sinking with the sun. I miss your tender kiss. The whole day through, I miss you most of all when day is done.
Will Friedwald, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, what do you personally love about Mildred Bailey singing?
Well, the fact that she's, like I say, she was one of the first to listen to Louis Armstrong, and that whole concept of spontaneity, of intimacy, which is, a trademark we associate with Crosby. And, of course, this is the defining characteristic of American, vernacular music and American singing. The whole concept of intimacy, of having this kind of direct relationship with the audience that really comes out. It's sort of based on electronic reproduction. I mean, it's the kind of thing that wasn't possible before the invention of the microphone. But at the same time, even though it's electronic, even though it relies on transistors and things like that, it's incredibly personal. I mean, it establishes this direct relationship between singer and audience, and Bailey is just about the first to do that. And besides which, she's got this amazingly appealing personality. I mean, she's one of the first popular singers or vocal artists to have what we consider now a personality, to have a distinct sort of charm and charisma that's carried from record to record. And you can really, there's a Mildred Bailey kind of a song, and by extension, there's a Mildred Bailey kind of a sound. She works with all kinds of different musicians, from, say, Duke Ellington musicians to Benny Goodman musicians. And, the sound of her records is amazingly consistent. I mean, there really is a whole Mildred Bailey musical universe.
What would you describe as the qualities of her singing?
Well, she has a... It's not a particularly high voice, but it sort of sounds deceptively high when you first hear it. But it is it's not a big screaming voice if you think that, say, the major singer in the blues and jazz sphere before Bailey, say that was Bessie Smith, I mean, that was a very big sound. And compared to, Bessie Smith, Mildred has a very, very small sound. It's a very personal kind of a thing, and it's a very... it has a kind of a unique sort of very humorous quality to it, a little girl kind of a quality to it. It's just very endearing. It's just, once you've heard Bailey, it's hard not to fall in love with her. It's hard not to, go along with her. And she's always eminently believable.
Bill Miller, who is a pianist who worked with her and with Sinatra, said that she never sang a song the same way twice. And she talks about that a little bit in a 1938 Downbeat interview that you quote in the liner notes. Would you paraphrase that for us?
Well, she... Bailey said that when she was a little kid, it was hard for her to afford to go and buy sheet music, even though she could play the piano. And, you know, if she had the chance, she could really say, you know, she could learn a song exactly the way it was written and perform it like that consistently. But she always said that, she didn't have any money and she couldn't afford to buy sheet music. So she just had to hear a song and remember it. And, of course, you know, when she was remembering it, there was an interpretive process going on because she wouldn't remember it exactly the way it was written, but she would change a note here and there. You know, she would change a rhythm, make one note higher, another lower. In fact, you know, she would personalize it. She would make it into something her own. And as she put it in that interview, later on, that process became known as swinging. That's the way she put it. And people liked it. People liked to hear what she would do with a song rather than just hear it strictly, you know, the way it was written. Of course, this is the basis of jazz singing. The whole concept of jazz singing is to personalize it and make it into, you know, to interpret it in such a way that, you know, Mildred Bailey doing Lover Come Back to Me is not the same piece of music as Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett or of course, you know, Nelson Eddy doing Lover Come Back to Me. They're all, you know, that's the great thing about the American popular song is that it's possible to be flexible with it so that each interpreter who does it makes it into, you know, the equivalent of a whole new piece of music. And Mildred Bailey is a very, very early example of that taking place. And, you know, in fact, you know, she did it so early and so, like, naturally that there really wasn't even a name for it at that point.
Why don't we hear Mildred Bailey singing Lover Come Back to Me? This was recorded in 1938 with Mildred Bailey and her orchestra, Teddy Wilson at the piano. Anything you want to say about this before we hear it, Will?
Oh, it's just an extraordinary, considering that the song was only about 10 years old then, and it came out of operetta. You know, it's from The New Moon by Sigmund Romberg, and it's meant to be, you know, sung by, you know, what we would think of as a very kind of stiff baritone in a very overtly classical, overtly theatrical way. And then to hear, you know, Mildred Bailey come along and, you know, this was really, you know, quite radically turning the song on its ear in those days. For her to come along and swing it and swing the hell out of it, it was just, you know, quite radical at that point. And yet, you know, it doesn't sound radical today. It just sounds perfectly natural. It just sounds like, you know, such an obvious and wonderful and, you know, inspired thing to do with the song.
Let's hear it. That's Mildred Bailey, recorded in 1938, one of the many recordings of hers featured on the new 10-CD box set, the complete Columbia recordings of Mildred Bailey. My guest, Will Friedwald, wrote the liner notes. Will, tell us something about Mildred Bailey's childhood, where she grew up, what her family was like.
Mildred Bailey was very closely associated with Bing Crosby from the early days. They both were born in 1903, of course. You know, for many years, she always put down her birth as being considerably later, but now we know, thanks to Gary Giddens, that it was indeed 1903. And they both grew up in, you know, northern Washington, And Mildred Bailey was believed to be, she's known to have been part Indian. And the interesting thing is that she was attracted to music at a very early age. And after her mother died, she had one of these horrible stepmothers that you read about in like Grimm's fairy tales. And the important thing about that is, you know making, sweet are the uses of adversity. Her situation at home was so awful that it was actually amounted to a good thing, because she left home very young. And, you know, became a professional musician very, very, very young, you know, like still in her teens. And she was, you know, singing professionally up and down the West Coast, you know, while still a teenager. And she managed to sort of set up a kind of camp in Los Angeles, where her younger brother, who was Bing Crosby's singing partner, where the two of them could sort of, you know, embark to when they were ready to start a professional music career.
My guest is Will Friedwald. He wrote the liner notes for the new 10-CD box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Will Friedwald wrote the liner notes for the new 10-CD collection, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. Bailey's brother, Al Rinker, was Bing Crosby's singing partner in the 20s. Bailey helped get them started when they visited her in Los Angeles, where she was singing in a speakeasy. I asked Will Friedwald how she helped them.
Well, she helped them both in terms of getting work and in terms of the content of their music. She was the one who knew what all the best songs were. She knew who the best musicians were. She knew what they should be listening to. She knew what records they should be studying. And also in terms of getting work, she knew where the jobs were. She knew what, you know, where they could finally get, you know, work as singers. And Crosby always gave her credit for that, always said that she was really, as he wrote in the early 60s, she was the one who gave him his start.
Now, one of the early recordings on this new Mildred Bailey box set just really astonished me, because I'd never heard her sound that way. This is a recording called I'd Like to Do Things for You, made in 1930, and she sounds very Betty Boop on it. And although Mildred Bailey has a kind of high, girlish-sounding voice, she's a very sophisticated singer. And this is so cute and so Betty Boop. What's the story behind this recording?
It's kind of fascinating in that she, Mildred Bailey, became a regular member of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra in 1929. And because, I believe that Whiteman was feuding with his record company, Columbia Records, at that point, he really wasn't in the studio that much, and Mildred did not get to make a record with that band until 31. But in the interim, she does this record of the song, I Like to Do Things for You, with Frank Trumbauer's orchestra, which is a spinoff of the Whiteman band. And like I said, like you say, the Betty Boop kind of a voice, which was, you know, introduced by Helen Kane, was very popular then. And the woman who sings the song in the movie The King of Jazz is a woman named Jeannie Lang, who's a very, very strict boop-boop-a-dooper. And, you know, for years it was thought that it was Jeannie Lang on this recording, because it does sound like her. But you know, this is her just about her first record. And it just happens to, you know, it's just Mildred Bailey was obviously asked to do a boop-boop-a-doop kind of a voice, and she does it very well. You know, this singing is way more annoying than, you know, her regular singing, but, you know, there you have it, you know. She sings in a similar voice about 10 years later on The Three Little Fishies, which is also this kind of, you know, children's song, so it's also appropriate for that kind of a voice.
Well, let's hear Mildred Bailey recorded in 1930, and this is what, her second recording?
Her second recording.
I'd like to fix your tie, smooth your hair, put things in order here and there, 'cause I'd like to do things for you. I'd like to pick the lint off your suit. I want to keep you nice and cute, 'cause I'd like to do things for you. There doesn't seem to be need for me to mention like that, 'cause I'd like to do things for you.
many of Mildred Bailey's recordings are with the vibraphonist and xylophone player Red Norvo, who was also, for some years, Mildred Bailey's husband. How did they meet?
They met in the Whiteman Band. Norvo had, you know, been playing around the Midwest, and finally he wound up in Chicago, and that was where Whiteman heard him and hired him and made him, you know, another attraction within the band, and the two fell in love and got married. And by the time they left the band, they were a team, and they stayed a team even, you know, after, for some time after their marriage fell apart. But they were married for about 10 years, and you know, they led this band together, and it became, you know, one of the great. Today, you know, unfortunately, little known, but it was really considered one of the great bands of the swing era by fans and critics and musicians at the time. And it was very, very, very highly regarded.
And what do you think they brought out in each other musically?
It's interesting because people think of the swing era, you know, even then there was this tendency to think of, you know, swing bands as loud and noisy. What the Bailey Norvo band was all about, they referred to it as soft, subtle swing, and which is a fairly apropos term, and it was a very musicianly band. It was about, you know, you could swing and not necessarily have to scream in people's ears. You know, there were ways of swinging that were, you know, much more subtle, and the two of them both had this in common with each other. I mean, just the fact that Norvo was a virtuoso soloist on the xylophone, which is not, you know, I mean, he had as much rhythm as Harry James, but he didn't have to make, you know, a whole lot of noise. And, of course, Bailey, you know, swung like crazy, and at the same time, you know, she never screamed. You know, she had this very soft, you know, soft, subtle swinging voice. And the two of them complemented each other beautifully. It was a really, and the whole band was structured around that. Virtually every number has a very prominent xylophone solo. And, you know, the two of them just really brought out the best in each other. And they were really one of the all-time great, you know, combinations of musician and singer.
Is there a recording that you think really illustrates that musical relationship between Mildred Bailey and Red Norvo?
That musical relationship is really, it's the point of the whole box. I mean, they recorded very prolifically. And most of the 10 CDs in this box are from, you know, kind of the two-year concentrated period of the band from 1937 to 1939. I think I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm is a really perfect example of Bailey and Norvo together at their best. I mean, her singing is so effervescent, and so is, you know, Norvo's solo. And the two of them, you can just see that they're on, you know, the same plane, the same page, as it were, spiritually and musically and rhythmically or whatever.
So here they are, Mildred Bailey and Red Norvo, recorded in 1937.
Keep me warm. I can't remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles form. What do I care if icicles form? I've got my love to keep me warm. Off with my overcoat. Off with my glove. I need no overcoat, I'm burning with love. My heart's on fire, the flame grows higher, so I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got
That's Mildred Bailey with Red Norvo, recorded in 1937, as featured on the new box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. My guest, Will Friedwald, wrote the liner notes. He's also the author of a book about Sinatra called Sinatra, The Song Is You. I'm interested in hearing about Mildred Bailey's relationship with some of the other great singers of her time, particularly Billie Holiday. She really liked Billie Holiday's singing. In fact, you say she helped launch Billie Holiday's career.
It's an interesting thing in that John Hammond, who was, of course, you know, rightfully credited with discovering Holiday, always told the story about hearing her for the first time in Harlem in 1933. And what he left out, or what, you know, seems to be the case that he left out, and is that Mildred Bailey and Red Norvo were with him at that point. And I've heard Red told me that story several times, that the three of them were up in Harlem, and they happened to hear this girl singing, and it was Mildred who actually said, "Wow, that girl really has something. You know, you should, you know, keep your eye on that one." And, you know, it's kind of a mystery why Hammond never mentioned that. But like I say, Norvo never took credit for it himself. He always said that it was Mildred. And for a while, Mildred even tried to help out the Holiday family when they were first getting started, and that Sadie Fagan, Billie Holiday's mother, worked as a maid, and the Norvos actually hired her for a while. And until apparently she was a complete screw-up as a maid, and it was Red who had to fire her, even though, you know, Mildred was opposed to it because she wanted to help out the Holidays or the Fagans. And Billie sort of got the idea that it was like a professional jealousy kind of a thing, and was, you know, very resentful of Mildred Bailey for a long time after that. But really, it was Mildred who, you know, pulled John Hammond's coattails to her to begin with, and, you know, really deserves a lot of credit for, you know, launching the career of Billie Holiday, as it were. And interestingly enough, 6 years later, the two of them heard Frank Sinatra before he was ever discovered. And at that point, they tried to hire him for, you know, the Bailey Norvo band, and it turned out he was already set to go with Harry James at that point. So, but Norvo always, you know, insisted that, you know, hearing Sinatra before he was discovered was the same kind of thrill as hearing Billie Holiday, you know, at that sort of point of, you know, embryonic discovery.
Will Friedwald wrote the liner notes to the new 10-CD box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. It's released by the mail order company Mosaic Records. We'll hear more of Bailey's music in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, John Ritter talks about his new movie, Panic, his 70s sitcom, Three's Company, and his father, singing cowboy Tex Ritter. And we talk more about singer Mildred Bailey.
It can happen. It's happened to me. It can happen to you. You cannot get away from what your heart will do. It can happen. Love falls from the sky when you're least expecting it to. It happens to millions of others. It can happen to you. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Will Friedwald. He wrote the extensive liner notes for the new 10-CD box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. It covers the years 1929 to 42. Friedwald is also the author of Sinatra, The Song Is You. I want to take a pause here and play another Mildred Bailey recording. And this is a novelty song that she handles awfully well. It's a song that's very associated with her. It's called Arthur Murray Taught Me Dancing in a Hurry. It's a Johnny Mercer lyric. She recorded it in 1942 with the Red Norvo Orchestra. Would you talk a little bit about this song and where it fits into her body of work?
What's always been fascinating to me about this song is that it was not written for her. It was actually introduced by Jimmy Dorsey's band and Helen O'Connell. And it was just, you know, another, you know, funny Johnny Mercer song. And Mildred Bailey recorded it very early and just took it over. And now it seems like such a perfect marriage of a singer and material. And, you know, it's hard to imagine anyone else doing it. And what's also amazing is that it just shows how funny she was and what a great sort of, you know, musical comedian she was. And not and that she's really, you know, deserves more credit in that area, because not only did she influence, you know, say, you know, Bing Crosby and Billie Holiday and lots of other, you know, great jazz and pop singers, but she's also a major musical comedian and sort of a forerunner to Martha Ray or Betty Hutton and people like that. And it's just a very funny, very, she, you know, Johnny Mercer's lyric is very clever and very witty, and she really, you know, she sings it for all it's worth.
Here she is in 1942.
Life was so calm and serene. Life was tray gay till that unlucky day I happened to read that magazine. Why did I read that advertisement where it said, since I Roomba Red thinks I'm sublime? Why, oh, why did I ever try when I didn't have the talent, I didn't have the money, and teacher did not have the time? Ma! Arthur Murray taught me dancing in a hurry. I had a week to spare. He showed me the groundwork, the walking around work, and told me to take it from there. Arthur Murray then advised me not to worry. It'd come out all right. To my way of thinking, it came out stinking. I don't know my left from my right. The people around me can all sing a one and a two and a three, but any resemblance to waltzing is just coincidental with me, 'cause Arthur Murray taught me dancing in a hurry.
That's Mildred Bailey, one of the recordings featured on the new 10-CD box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. My guest, Will Friedwald, wrote the liner notes. He's also the author of the book Sinatra, The Song Is You. You describe Mildred Bailey as having had self-esteem problems and a weight problem. She was quite heavy. How did that affect her life and her career?
Well, I think eventually, as she got heavier and heavier, she began to get into her 40s, you know, it kind of undermined her self-esteem and made her much more difficult to work with. And that's generally acknowledged to be one of the factors that broke up, you know, the marriage and broke up the great, you know, Norval Bailey band. And, you know, as she got older, and she never got all that old, but, you know, just as it went on, it got more and more severe, and she had more and more of a weight problem, and these things all became kind of a vicious cycle. And she really didn't do that much in the 40s. You know, sort of after the war, she kind of faded and faded. And then, you know, musical tastes were changing at the same time as well, and she must have seemed, you know, sort of like something from the past by the late 40s. And, you know, that was gradually the end of it for her. She made some nice things in the late 40s, but recorded, you know, this is really the bulk of her career is in this box. And, you know, everything that comes after is, you know, there's much less of it. You know, she was much less productive and prolific afterwards.
Now, she was broke at the end of her life. How did she end up broke after this very prolific output and after having achieved, you know, considerable popularity?
it just was a case of diminishing returns. You know, after a while, she you know, wasn't, you know, well enough to consistently work, and she hadn't kept up, you know, hadn't kept up the recording career. And, you know, it was just, you know, the career gradually diminished. At the end, both Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, you know, were very gallant in terms of supporting her and, you know, making sure she wasn't, you know, making sure she could keep her farm and things like that, and making sure that her hospital bills were paid. You know, at the end, she really seems to have been, you know, undermined by, it sounds trivial to put it this way, but you know, a serious, you know, lack of self-esteem. And that really seems to have been, you know, the thing that must have psychologically motivated all these, you know, bad health problems and things like that. They all were kind of supporting each other or undermining each other at that point.
Let's close with one of the later recordings included on this new 10 CD box set. And this was a song that I believe was written for her. It's called Don't Take Your Love From Me. Written for her, Will?
Yes. It was written by Henry Nemo, who was a character that was always kind of hanging around Bailey. And it's funny that most people that knew him or were around at that point just describe him as one of the all-time great nut jobs of the era. Apparently, he's always like pulling some wacky stunt after another. Although, you know, people that didn't know him personally and just know the quality of his music, you know, really regard him as kind of one of the great obscure songwriters who came up with all these kind of interesting tunes that, you know, are all fairly substantial. And the sort of the two impressions of Henry Nemo seem very, very much in contrast to each other. But it's a lovely song, and it was obviously written with Bailey in mind. And this early version has a couple of different lyrics than the ones we're used to hearing, you know, when the song kind of became cemented later on. And it's just, you know, an outstanding example of Mildred Bailey singing a ballad at her very best.
Now, Alec Wilder is one of the directors of this session, and he's best known for his book, you know, An American Popular Song. And he also wrote a lot of songs and was very much into art song. And how did Mildred Bailey get hooked up with Alec Wilder?
Mitch Miller told me about that. They were, you know, they were just great fans when they were in college together. They were just great fans of the Bailey Norville Band, because that, both that band and In Red's sort of experimental music, it was sort of like opening a door as to different ways in which pop music and jazz music can go. Not necessarily with exclusively a classical leaning or an attempt to merge jazz with classical, but in an attempt to sort of open sort of the boundaries of what jazz and pop were and perhaps bring in some sort of classical techniques. And this was something that appealed very much to Mitch Miller and Alec Wilder, who were both, you know, classical music students who had a great, you know, a very strong love for popular music and jazz. And after they graduated and were doing, you know, professionals, they you know, approached Bailey and Norvo about, you know, the idea of doing something together. And it turned out to be something very similar to the octet music that Alec Wilder had been writing at that point. And it was a very interesting, it's another whole aspect of Bailey's career that's worthy of studying, are these really interesting sort of chamber jazz sessions that, you know, she does around 1939, 1940.
I think in this recording, her voice is sounding more weathered than the girlish voice of the earlier sessions.
Well, she certainly sounds older than I like to do things for you, right? yeah, definitely. She was, you know, like 36 or 37 at this point, and, you know, had a lot of heartache and heartbreak behind her already by this point.
Will Friedwald wrote the liner notes to the new 10-CD box set, The Complete Columbia Recordings of Mildred Bailey. It's released by the mail order company, Mosaic Records. Here's Mildred Bailey, recorded in 1940.
Tear a star from out the sky, and the sky feels blue. Tear a flower from its stem, and the stem weeps too. Take your heart away from mine, and mine will surely break. My life is what you make. So, darling, please keep the spark away. Would you take the wings from birds so that they can't fly? Would you take the ocean's roar and leave but a sigh? All this your heart won't let you do. Then if it's all the same to
Coming up, John Ritter. He's co-starring in the new film Panic. This is Fresh Air. One guy sharing an apartment with two women, a premise that gave Three's Company 7 years of sexual innuendos and double entendres. The show premiered in 1977 and is back on Nick at Night. John Ritter's starring role in Three's Company gave him a reputation as a fine comedic actor. He had two subsequent sitcoms, Hooperman and Hearts of Fire. Ritter grew up in a show business family. His father was singing cowboy and country music star Tex Ritter. John Ritter is now starring on Broadway in the Neil Simon comedy The Dinner Party. He co-starred in the independent film Sling Blade. He's also made guest appearances on shows like Ally McBeal, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and TV Funhouse. He's currently co-starring in the independent film Panic. He plays a psychotherapist. Here's a scene from the opening of the film in which W.H. Macy, the film's star, comes for his first appointment with the therapist.
Come on in, Alex.
Sit down.
There's nothing wrong with me. Excuse me? I'm not sick or, you know, crazy.
I'm a therapist, Alex.
Therapy is as common as gasoline. It's what we need to keep us going. It's not a mental ward. Please. So tell me, Sam Grayley sent you my way?
Yes.
Sam's a good doctor. How old are you, Alex?
What are you doing?
Making notes?
No notes.
Okay. No notes. What do you do for a living?
I've got two jobs. I run a small mail order business out of the house. Lawn ornaments, kitchen gewgaws, sexual aids, things like that.
And the rest of the time?
I work for my father.
Doing what?
I kill people.
John Ritter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you to describe your role in Panic.
It seems like every hitman or mafia guy has a therapist these days. So I'm one of the psychologist who happens to meet this guy who's very troubled, Bill Macy, and I find out he has a very unusual occupation. And the movie is, even though you might think, oh, I've heard that story before. This is in new hands. This guy named Henry Brummel, who wrote and directed this, is a completely original filmmaker. And I knew Bill Macy because he and I did a Steve Martin play together with Felicity Huffman and some wonderful actors. We went to the Aspen Comedy Festival a couple of years ago, and we actually won Best Ensemble, whatever that means. I guess they liked our clothes.
how did you get the part in Panic? Do you know what led the filmmaker to think of you for the psychologist?
I don't. His wife, Trish Sudik, is a writer, and she was one of the great actresses at USC in the drama department. She was hilarious and just so touching, and she went off to act and be a professional writer, and she married Henry. And I've sort of run into them here and there, but I guess he really liked Sling Blade and some other independent films he saw me do, one called Montana and another one called A Gun, A Car, and A Blonde, something like that. And little-known independent films that people, they're so independent they refuse to be seen.
Now, I want to ask you about another film that you were in, Sling Blade. which written and directed by Billy Bob Thornton, mm-hmm. who also starred in the movie. And he plays a man who is mentally challenged. And in this scene, you've invited him over for a talk at a local diner.
But you see, you and I are a lot alike. Strange as that may seem, I don't mean physically or even mentally, really. But, well, emotionally. Actually, the hand that we've been dealt in life, we're different. People see us as being different anyway. You've got your affliction or whatever, and mine's not as easy to see. I'm just going to say it. I'm gay. Does that surprise you? That I'm gay? You know what gay is, don't you?
I don't reckon.
Sexual. I like men. Sexually.
Not funny, ha-ha, funny, queer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very offensive way to put it.
John Ritter, now this movie seems to me like it was a real change of pace for you. How did this role affect your image?
Well, Billy and I had known each other actually from network TV. We did a series called Hearts of Fire together where we played best friends, and we spent a lot of time together and really made each other laugh doing improvs and everything. And Billy is a wonderful writer. He wrote a couple of movies with Tom Epperson that were already produced, and the first thing he wrote on his own was this little short film based on this character he used to do in his performance art. And they made a little 10-minute film, but he didn't quite like it. It was in black and white, and he thought that the director, well, I don't want to say anything bad about the director, but he wanted to direct it himself and make it, you know, his vision. And he said, I'm going to do a full-length movie, this time in color, and I want to take this guy out of the mental institution into the town. And I said, Billy, that sounds great, you know. And he said, would you be in it? And I thought, yeah, you know, sort of like a day of maybe a guy in a gas station or something. But he said, no, it's a part. He never told me what it was because he hadn't written it yet. But then when I read it and he told me what he wanted me to look like, his gym teacher, but I was basically, the character was his music teacher, who was an extremely closeted gay man in the 50s in Arkansas, a little town in Arkansas, who had a wife and two kids, but was just so obviously gay and sort of tortured about it, because in a little town in Arkansas in the 50s, if you were gay, you probably would be dead by the end of the week, he said.
And what did you do to get into character for this role?
Actually, it's one of those wonderful things where the script is right there. Mm-hmm. All of us looked at the script, and all the information you need is in the pages. And so he would tell his story about being in St. Louis and his father. His father was a monster, and I had some backstory about that. You know, some of it was mine, some of it was Billy's. We talked about what he let me choose my name, and I chose Vaughn because I was driving by a supermarket then. It could have just as well been Ralph's or Dwayne Reed or somebody like that, but it was Vaughn. And I chose Cunningham because I always wondered what happened to Ron Howard's brother, Richie Cunningham's brother on Happy Days. And there's a little, he had a brother for one season and then they killed him off or something. I thought, well, it would be funny if I was Richie's brother.
My guest is John Ritter. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Ritter. He's currently starring on Broadway in Neil Simon's The Dinner Party, and he's co-starring in the independent film Panic. Ritter's father was singing cowboy and country music star Tex Ritter. John's mother, Dorothy Fay, was Tex's leading lady in his B-Westerns. Tex Ritter was friends with other singing cowboys like Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. I asked John Ritter if he ever got to meet them.
Roy Rogers is as nice as you please. I did an interview with Gene and Roy and Rex Allen and Jimmy Wakely, who were the other singing cowboys, and my father. I interviewed my mom because my father had died, and that show won a local Emmy in Los Angeles for the best documentary and the best written documentary. Roy was just so sweet. He said, "Let's go have dinner on me." And so the little thumbnail crew and I went out to this restaurant. I think it was called the Velvet Turtle or something like that. And Roy came in and, "Hi, Roy. Hi, Velma. The usual, honey? Yes, you bet." And I thought, I wonder what Roy Rogers' usual is, you know? I bet it's a piece of ribeye, raw, you know, with, you know, baked potato, no vegetables, and a shot of bourbon, Jack Daniels. And she brings down a glass of milk and strawberry pie with whipped cream. And she said, "Don't tell Dale now. She doesn't want me eating this, but this is my, oh, I love this." And I just saw him eat pie and milk. It just was he was exactly that. And that was the thing about those guys. They were really, you know, really heroic people, I thought, those singing cowboys. They just played themselves.
Now, your father actually ran for office. He ran as a Republican in Tennessee for Senate.
With,
I think, Johnny Cash as the chairman of his finance committee.
Well, Johnny Cash was so great because my father ran, the Howard Baker people in Tennessee wanted a more moderate Republican than this up-and-comer named, Brock, I think his name was, who was very, very wealthy and very conservative. And so they asked my dad to run because my dad and Howard Baker had, you know, views eye to eye. My father's very, very astute politically and a very smart guy. And he ran, but he lost. But the thing that we all know now, didn't know then too much in 1970, was the debt that can accrue when you run a campaign. And Dad was about $80,000 in debt, and all the people sort of said, "We'll see you around." And then Johnny Cash, who always loved my father, and my father stuck by Johnny Cash early on in Johnny Cash's career when he was having some hard times. He held a benefit for my father, you know, and had all these country music stars come and sing in 1971, and they raised about $42,000, which in those days was huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just huge. And that erased so much of the problem, you know, and it was, I've always loved the Johnny Cash and his family for that.
1970 was a year, was part of a period when there was really quite a generation gap politically between a lot of teenagers and their parents. And one of the reasons for that was the war in Vietnam. Another reason was all the cultural changes and marijuana and LSD that were part of youth culture. What were your politics compared to your father's? Was this a source of friction in your family like it was in so many others?
My father was a Goldwater Republican. And then he was a little more moderate, but he supported he was a Reagan supporter and all of, you know, the Republicans. Didn't too much like Nixon that much, but, you know, voted for him. Whereas my brother and I were into the Kennedys. And but we always argued. My father always wanted us to argue, you know, sort of he'd sort of switch on the Socratic dialogue where he'd ask a question and we'd say something. Then he'd ask another question. And then we'd answer it. And then he said, "Well, if you think that, then how about this?" You know, he put us on our toes. We had to really know what we were talking about.
So he wanted you to defend your point of view.
Yeah. In other words, he wasn't going to say, "Well, you might disagree when you have a little money and property." You know, now it's very easy since we're taking care of you to say all this stuff. But, you know, he said, "I was a Democrat too, but I figured, you know, Franklin Roosevelt four times is enough." And I, you know, so then after Roosevelt, he voted Republican. He voted for Eisenhower and all that. But I did love him for this. Eldridge Cleaver wanted to speak at, he wanted to teach at Berkeley. And my brother and I were saying he should be allowed to teach. And Dad said the regents, which were very conservative, should say yes or no. And the students, which were very liberal, wanted him. And I said, but the regents don't know anything about the Black African-American experience, and these kids should know what's going on. And so I gave my father a copy of Eldridge Cleaver's bestseller called Soul on Ice, and I inscribed it as if it were from Eldridge to my brother, Tex. Listen, let me tell you what's happening. You know, I did this whole thing up against the wall. You going to be my friend or my foe? Anyway, so signed with respect, Eldridge Cleaver. Anyway, I gave it to Dad as sort of a joke, but God love him, he read the whole thing. And he said, well, he did make some good points. And I thought, that's very, very generous of my father, mm-hmm. And then he went to Vietnam to entertain the troops with my brother. My brother came back wide-eyed, and he said, well, it's Sodom and Gomorrah over there. We got to get our boys home. It's just the most corrupt city I've ever seen in my life. So we've just got to just leave that country as soon as possible. And I said, right on, Dad, man, see, you're into ending the war. He said, yeah, just go in there, bomb Hanoi, and then bring our boys home. I said, well, that's not exactly what I was thinking about, bombing Hanoi and getting out of South Vietnam. But, he was great. We never had a dull moment.
Well, John Ritter, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, I had a great time talking to you.
John Ritter is starring on Broadway in the Neil Simon comedy The Dinner Party and is co-starring in the independent film Panic. You can see his sitcom Three's Company on Nick at Night. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Shurrock, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Here's John Ritter's father, Tex Ritter, with the theme from High Noon, which he sang for the movie.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling. On this our wedding day, do not forsake me, oh my darling. Wait long. I do not know what fate awaits me. I only know I must be brave, and I must face a man who hates me. I'll lie a coward, a craven coward. I'll lie a coward in my grave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Island Books Division, publisher of Losing Julia by Jonathan Hull, a novel set during World War I and today. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
George W. Bush makes his first international trip as president on Friday when he travels to Mexico to meet with President Vicente Fox. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to journalist Sam Quiñones. He's been covering Mexico for over 7 years and has a new book called True Tales from Another Mexico. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.